Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this Labor Day and assess the damage Donald Trump is doing to the lives of working Americans with his recent assault on unions and his corporatist takeover of the judiciary, as Trump recites right-wing idiocy speaking out against big tech, albeit in a dangerous and cynical defense of Alex Jones's right to spew out his conspiracies and hate speech online. We will speak with Stacey Mitchell, the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. She joins us for an update on the real issues facing labor and the threats posed by the gig economy from companies like Google and Amazon, whose founder, Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world with a net worth of over $155 billion, can't even conceive of paying his workers better wages or his fair share of taxes, and instead would prefer to erect a giant rocket ship to Mars as a monument to his wealth. Then we'll go to West Virginia, where the recent wave of teacher strikes have shown hopeful signs on the ground of what can be accomplished when workers come together and demand economic justice. Anne-Marie Lafazo, a professor at West Virginia University College of Law, where she teaches labor and employment law, joins us to discuss how, in her red state, where super-rich political leaders have conned the electorate into voting for a plutocratic agenda veiled in faux populism, just like in the case of our president's election, West Virginians are becoming activated as they see the fruits of victory from these massively popular wildcat strikes. Then finally, we'll speak with Sam Pizzagatti, a veteran labor journalist and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, whose latest book is The Case for a Maximum Wage. He joins us to discuss his article at inequality.org, Would You Recognize a Plutocracy If You Saw It?, and give us an update on the state of organized labor in our country, which appears to be becoming less of a democracy and more of a plutocracy. But on a cheery note on this Labor Day, a century ago, Americans faced a plutocracy just like ours today, and they beat it back just as we can today. And joining us now is Stacey Mitchell, who is the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the author of Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses. Her recent reports include Amazon's Stranglehold and Monopoly Power and the Decline of Small Business. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stacey Mitchell.
It's great to be with you.
And thanks for joining us on Labor Day. And it is very sad the extent to which small business is being eviscerated across the country, and that the power of these huge corporations like Facebook, Google, and Microsoft. I mean, it used to be like 10 years ago, ExxonMobil was the number one most powerful company in the world. It's completely flipped. And if you think these companies like Alphabet are powerful now, in 10 years' time, based on the trajectory they're on, they're going to be even more powerful. So we have a president who's finally taking on Google, but for the stupidest reasons, and to do with their algorithms in terms of how they aggregate the news. And at what point do you think the Washington establishment will deal with the real issue of antitrust and monopoly?
I hope that it's inevitable. I mean, I think it's very difficult to have a situation where you have companies like Amazon that increasingly are the infrastructure for commerce. I mean, they really are the gatekeeper and the interface for the buying and selling of goods. Their interest isn't so much in dominating the market as it is in being the market. So you've got these, as you noted, these big platform monopolies like Google and Amazon that are the intermediary areas of both information and commerce. And that ultimately is untenable in a democracy. It means not only rising levels of economic inequality, but it also means a loss of political control and inability to steer the direction of our own society because we're turning so much power over to these giant tech companies. And so I feel as if inevitably Congress is going to have to deal with that. And the faster that lawmakers get out ahead of this, the better. The good news is that there is this growing bottom-up movement really demanding that lawmakers look at antitrust and the ways in which the antitrust has gone wrong in recent decades.
Well, we know that Trump hates Jeff Bezos because, one, he's a real billionaire as opposed to the fake billionaire that Donald Trump is. But, two, he owns the Washington Post, which is, as Trump calls it, the fake media. But it's extraordinary that as much as Trump is on this jihad against Bezos, Bezos is getting these massive contracts with the Department of Defense, billions of dollars, to take literally all of the Department of Defense's data and move it onto a classified platform in the cloud.
You know, it's really, you know, it's a terrible thing when you have a president who gets on Twitter and sort of indiscriminately attacks various companies because he sees them as his personal enemies. And so, you know, that's unacceptable, I think. That said, I think we shouldn't get distracted. I've been dismayed at the number of people who've responded to that in the need to defend Amazon. And I would argue that Amazon is as big a threat to democracy, if not more of a threat to democracy in the long run than Donald Trump even is. Amazon has gotten to where it is, not just because of its innovations and its brought to the table, but it's also very strategically, all the way from the beginning. You know, when Jeff Bezos founded the company in 1995, one of the very early strategies that he hit upon and has used extremely effectively ever since is to get government handouts and government favors that are not available to his competitors. And we're certainly seeing that right now, whether it's the auction that he's initiated among cities who are vying to get Amazon's second headquarters. We've got offers on the table from some places as high as $8 billion in public dollars set to be handed over to Amazon if they locate in Maryland, $7 billion if they locate in New Jersey, you know, and on down the list. I mean, this is extraordinary. And Amazon, as you noted, has also been extremely adept at getting these government contracts, and not only getting government defense contracts. I mean, they're a major provider of cloud services for the CIA. They're in line to get this big Defense Department contract that's being decided this year. They've also got a grip on a growing amount of just sort of the commercial goods that the federal government purchases. And they're actually going after the purchasing of local schools and cities and counties across the country. And part of how they've been able to do that is by developing this very cozy relationship with government. And then when they get in there, they leverage that relationship to actually push other competitors out of the market. So it's both a horse at the public trough, if you will, and sort of gaining the advantage that comes with just getting public dollars. But it's also an anti-competitive strategy in terms of how Amazon then uses those government contracts to undermine competitors in that space.
And again, I'm speaking with Stacy Mitchell, the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the author of Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses. Her recent reports include Amazon's Stranglehold and Monopoly Power and the Decline of Small Business. So Senator Sanders has taken on Amazon in a kind of war of words. But I also understand, and I may have not have this entirely correctly, because I'm trying to remember exactly where I saw it, but I believe maybe it was Human Rights Watch or some human rights organization was critical of the working conditions at Amazon. But certainly Senator Sanders has made no secret of the fact that they don't pay a living wage. And he's called upon Bezos, who's worth about $155 billion, to basically take care of your workers. And Sanders implored Bezos to, quote, pay your workers a living wage and improve working conditions at Amazon warehouses. So on this Labor Day, let's talk about the new labor market, the gig economy, the idea that people, first of all, that they can, Amazon can blackmail cities and states in a competition to get their headquarters with massive subsidies. But then it's all to do with the idea that they're offering up jobs in the community. But what kind of jobs are these?
They're incredibly demanding and punishing jobs at Amazon warehouses. You know, these are jobs where people are on their feet, running around, lifting, standing, reaching under things. And it is very much a situation where you're a cog in the machine, you know, quite literally. A lot of Amazon's warehouses are highly automated, and people have these handheld devices or things that are attached to them that count down the number of seconds that they have in order to reach for a particular item or to get something off a shelf or to do some type of action. And they're not being helped by the machines, but they are in sort of a cog. They're serving those machines in the process. So it's very automated. It's a dehumanizing in many respects work environment. And it's also very low paid. We did an analysis of Amazon wages. We looked at hundreds of data points across 11 metro areas. This was in 2016. And we found at that time the average wage in Amazon warehouses was under $12 an hour. We also found that about 40% of the workers in a typical Amazon warehouse are temps. They are temporary employees that Amazon usually hires through a staffing agency. And it does that in order to, be able to have them come and go as it pleases. But also, if they're injured on the job, their workers' comp claims don't come to Amazon. They go through the staffing agency. These are not great jobs. And I think, the other thing that I would mention in this context is that Amazon is eliminating a lot more jobs than it's creating, because a lot of communities are losing retail jobs. We're losing small businesses. A lot of the other pathways to the middle class are being really squeezed out of the market by Amazon, and what it's offering us in return are a smaller number of not very good jobs.
So when you said earlier, Stacey Mitchell, that Amazon is not just trying to join the market, they're trying to be the market. There's some concern, for example, when they bought Whole Foods, that that was the nose of the camel in terms of moving into that kind of part of the retail market. But explain your thesis, if you will.
Yeah. Even just a few years ago, when people were looking to buy something online, they would typically go to a search engine and they would type in what they were looking for, running shoes or a toaster oven or whatever it was. And they would get a variety of different results. It would include Amazon. It would include other retailers. It might include a local independent store, for example, in their community. Now, more than half of all shoppers start directly at Amazon. And that's been a shift. It's been driven a lot by the Prime program, Amazon Prime, and also increasingly by Alexa, their voice assistant. This has enabled Amazon to develop a really sticky relationship with customers. And what that means is that for any other company in the economy that wants to sell consumer goods, whether it's a retailer, small retailer, large retailer, a small manufacturer, large manufacturer, every other company that wants to reach consumers online is increasingly facing this really difficult decision. They either continue to have their own website and there's less and less traffic out there for them to attract, or they become a third-party seller on Amazon's website. And growing numbers of companies are finding that that's what they're having to do in order to continue to reach customers. When they become a seller on Amazon's website, they hand over to Amazon data about their transactions, about their products, they hand over their customer relationships, and they hand over a substantial share of their revenue. We know from a lot of research that's been done by Harvard Business School and others that Amazon uses that information about those sellers and what they're selling to compete against them. It looks at what they're selling well, brings those items into its own inventory, and then gives itself top billing in the search results on its website. It also squeezes those companies in various ways. And the point that I think is really critical here is that this is not a market. What Amazon is looking to do is to replace a market. A market is an open arena, is an open space that is, governed by public rules where everyone has an equal opportunity to compete. On Amazon's platform, we have a private arena where other companies are having to play by Amazon's rules and where there is not an equal opportunity to compete. So this is fundamentally anti-democratic, what it is that they're setting up. And that basic conflict of interest, that ability of Amazon, the dependence that other companies have on Amazon if they want to reach the market, and the fact that Amazon is also competing against them, is really a fundamental problem with this company. If you think about it from Amazon's point of view, it's an incredibly lucrative thing that they have set up here. I mean, essentially, they are the sort of modern day railroad. Other companies that want to reach the market, need to have access to that infrastructure. And that power enables Amazon to decide, well, here are certain goods and services that we want to offer. We've picked out the items we think are going to be most lucrative for us to do. And we will privilege our own products on that infrastructure, and we'll make other competitors essentially invisible to consumers. And for everything else that we don't want to deal with, everything else that's bought and sold in the economy, we'll let other companies do that, but we'll charge essentially a kind of tax on their trade through the fees that it charges those companies to access its platform. So no matter what the transaction is, Amazon is making money, either doing it itself or taking revenue off the top from other companies. It is a very exquisitely designed machine for funneling wealth to Amazon.
And so that's what you mean when you say Amazon is laying the infrastructure for the new retail economy.
That's right. And, you know, we talk about Amazon as though they're a retailer, but really what they really are is an infrastructure company. It's about controlling the platform that other people need to use in order to get to market. And, you know, I've been talking a lot about the online platform, the site where people shop, but Amazon is also making moves to control these other big chunks of infrastructure. So they control about a third of the world's cloud computing capacity. And what that means is that a lot of their competitors like Netflix, Condé Nast, the big publisher, Comcast, a lot of other companies that compete with Amazon in various ways also rely on Amazon Web Services to get to market. So we have the same dynamic going on in that way. And then Amazon is also increasingly moving into package delivery and shipping. And, you know, they're looking to supplant UPS and the post office, and they're making big inroads in that. They're using Whole Food stores as part of that strategy, also using a gig labor model and undermining what are unionized employees at UPS and the Postal Service. And again, their idea there is it's not just about delivering their own stuff, but it's about being the gatekeeper, the delivery service for other firms, and being able to essentially extract rents, if you will, from those other firms, extract wealth from those other firms. So ultimately, at the end of the day, this is so fundamentally different than Walmart, which is also, you know, a big company that has monopoly power in some sectors, and I'm, you know, deeply concerned about. But Walmart is just a retailer. Amazon is something fundamentally different. This is a new kind of monopoly, and one that I don't think people can be. We really need to be quite alarmed about.
And again, these big five companies: Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, and Microsoft. Microsoft, of course, just reached the $1 trillion mark in terms of its market cap. And they have spent collectively in 2017 lobbying the U.S. government the $50 million, which of course is small change considering Jeff Bezos' net worth of $155 billion. So give us a sense of what the chances are of some antitrust action, given that we have money-driven politics. Our legislators have essentially been turned into telemarketers. They spend all their time raising money and very little time doing the people's business. So, needless to say, he who has the most money in Washington buys the most politicians.
We have been here before, and I think that's, you know, a really encouraging thing to reference. You know, we have been in this situation as a country before. We were here in the 1920s, for example, when we had just enormous levels of concentration across the economy, small numbers of companies that controlled whole industries, record levels of inequality, a lot of political corruption, you know, a lot of the same kinds of things that we're seeing now. And there really was both a bottom-up movement and good political leadership that eventually addressed that in the 1930s. You know, Franklin Roosevelt came along and he looked across the country and he recognized that, you know, the farmers that were protesting, New York banks that were fleecing them, you know, farmers across the Great Plains, that the folks in small towns who were fighting AMP, which was the Walmart of its day, the big grocery chain, the folks in cities who were fighting against these electric company monopolies that used to price gouge. You know, he looked out there and saw all of this kind of local activity that people were sort of fighting back against the corporate powers that they found in their own lives and in their own communities. And Roosevelt really really recognized that the root cause of all of that was monopoly. It was corporate power. And he campaigned on that issue, and he won, and he built in his second term, he built this, really robust approach to enforcing our antitrust laws. And for decades, we enforced those laws quite well. There was a sea change in the 1980s, embraced, started under Ronald Reagan, embraced by some subsequent Democratic administrations that really undermined our antitrust and changed the way that we enforce those laws. There is now beginning to be a move back in the other direction. And it's very encouraging. We've got economists, legal scholars, lots of people now who are doing work and showing the ways in which concentration is really harming Americans and harming the economy and our democracy. And we're beginning to see voices in terms of political leaders who are speaking out on this. You know, we had the formation of an antitrust caucus in Congress last year, which was a huge development. Both the Republican and Democratic parties in the last presidential election included antitrust in their platforms. That was the first time the word antitrust showed up in either party's platform in decades. We've got folks like Elizabeth Warren who are outlining very specific kinds of policies and she's been a leader in calling for the revival of antitrust. We've got Zephyr Teachout in New York who's running for attorney general and is running on a strong antitrust platform. So is Keith Ellison who's running for attorney general in Minnesota. All of these things are very new just in the last couple of years. And so we've got, an uphill fight and got a lot of work to do as citizens to take back our country. But there are some good signs. The kindling is there and there's some people really speaking out.
And meanwhile, the richest man in the world, the owner of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, with his $155 billion valuation, of course, it tends to fluctuate, particularly when Trump attacks Amazon. His ambition is to colonize Mars, is it not? I mean, he doesn't seem to be, as a human being, he doesn't seem to be interested in the earthbound problems of improving life on this planet, but rather having this fantasy of colonizing space.
That's right. Jeff Bezos told a German media outlet recently that he didn't quite know what to do with his $150 billion in personal wealth, except to spend it on going to space. I think a lot of people found that quite shocking and a real measure of perhaps how out of touch he is even with his own workforce. I also, I think one of the things that he's up to these days that I find especially both noteworthy and astonishing is that he's creating a palace in Washington, D.C., right in the heart of the people's capital. Bezos bought the largest house. I don't even know if you could call it a house, a mansion. He bought the largest mansion in Washington, D.C., and has been engaged in recent months in a massive renovation project. You can actually see the drawings for this online. And, it's a palace. It's a space with huge ballrooms, with a big circular driveway, with areas for servants and caterers and so on. I mean, this is a place where he is going to host the nation's elites, for various kinds of social functions. And, I think our founding fathers and mothers would be, rolling over in their graves if they could see this. And we should be outraged ourselves.
Well, Stacey Mitchell, I thank you so much for joining us on this Labor Day.
It's great to be with you. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Stacey Mitchell, who is the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the author of Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses. Her recent reports include Amazon's Stranglehold and Monopoly Power and the Decline of Small Business. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into hopeful signs for labor from the popular teachers' strikes.
And all your proof of energy. We are the robots. We are the robots. We are the robots. We are the robots.
my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working man blues. Well, I'm sailing on back, ready for the long haul, tossed by the winds and the seas. I'll drag them all.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now on this Labor Day is Anne-Marie Lafazo, a professor of law at West Virginia University College of Law, where she teaches labor and employment law, jurisprudence, and comparative labor law. She is currently a leadership fellow in the Office of the Associate Vice President for Creative and Scholarly Activity and a research scholar for the NYU Center for Labor and Employment. And Dr. Lafazo spent 10 years as an attorney with the National Labor Relations Board's appellate and Supreme Court branches. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anne-Marie Lafazo.
Thank you, Ian.
So last time we spoke was about the West Virginia teachers' strike, and frankly, that was a pretty hopeful moment, I think, in terms of labor. We get nothing but bad news, you know. The unions are losing their membership. They're down to 7% or so of the private workforce. We know the Supreme Court has ruled against public employers unions recently, and which is also going to defund the Democrats. But the wave of teacher wildcats spread from West Virginia to Oklahoma and to Kentucky and had pretty powerful results. And frankly, in Oklahoma, the legislators who voted against the teachers all got booted out in the recent primaries.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, actually, how powerful people are when they come together in common cause and they put their message forward. And that's why many people are afraid of any group that comes together, because it will challenge the establishment. Right? I mean, isn't that what Trump's – actually, if you think about it, Trump does that himself as a one person, but he's a very powerful person as the president. Here, the working person is getting together and challenging the establishment.
Right. But there's no comparison in the sense that Trump ran as a populist but is governed as a plutocrat.
Absolutely. I don't – and that's what I hope that the working person eventually sees. I mean, you got to remember – almost all of us are working class, and by that I mean we have to work in order to live. Most of us can't just live off the income of our investments. That means, I don't know what percentage, but very high in the 90s of us are, in that sense, working class. And I was very hopeful that Trump, as a populist, would have done many things for labor, but he's actually harmed labor very, very much from his selection for who's on the National Labor Relations Board, to his health care policies, to his trade policies. And yeah, even in trade, you would have thought that those would have been really pro-labor policies, but actually they've turned out to be disasters for working people. But you're right, there is some hope in that people are coming together. I don't think they've yet tied it to Trumpism, but I think that people realize that they're getting a short deal, the short end of the stick, and that they need to come together and say, no, enough is enough. We haven't been paid enough. We're entitled to benefits. We are entitled to to have a living wage, and that we need to be able to, this is the greatest country in the world. Why can't we have things that other countries already have and take as a given?
Well, your state, West Virginia, I think is a key state in the sense that it's very much a working class state with coal miners, but you also have coal barons like Blankenship and the governor, Jim Justice, right? These are, what, billionaires or multimillionaires? So how do you explain that paradox that a working class state could be politically captured? And, of course, the senator Caputo is totally in the pocket of big coal.
Well, I think part of it is that many people in West Virginia believe that their future is tied to coal. And they believed that Obama was the one who got rid of coal jobs. which really isn't true. I mean, it's a much more complex situation than that. That has to do in part with shale gas, in part with supply and demand, the very warm winters leading to less demand, the portfolio, energy portfolio is much more diversified than it's ever been. But unfortunately, there is a lot of, there's a narrative that's going out there that coal means jobs. And so if you are very concerned about having a job and keeping your jobs, which I know many of my friends are, they're coal miners or they're spouses of coal miners or they work in the coal industry. And if you believe that, then you're going to vote for someone who is going to be as pro-coal as possible, rather than thinking really, I think, long-term, which would be coal is not going to be here forever, even though it has been very good to West Virginians, very good. But we are an energy state, so which party or which person is going to represent my interest of having a diversified portfolio? Why aren't we creating a diversified economy in West Virginia? When you have one, it's like having a stock portfolio and you only have one stock. If that stock goes down, then you lose all your money. And what I think West Virginians need to start to realize is that we need to put our, we need to have a diversified portfolio of different businesses, which they are. I mean, that is starting to happen. And one of the, I think the largest employer in the state is actually West Virginia University. But we need to understand that there has to be other, there needs to be cross-training for other jobs, that not just energy jobs, but and maybe even bring in the entertainment industry, and just that's something that I think we need that message here. You should recall that although Trump was very popular in West Virginia, so was Bernie Sanders. So it would be interesting if a Bernie Sanders type candidate ran in West Virginia, whether or not he or she would be able to win. I think there's a good chance, actually.
Well, they have the opposite, though, in Senator Manchin. And
that's true.
You know, where the conventional wisdom amongst the establishment Democrats is you've got to be more like Republicans in order to get elected. But last week we saw down in Florida a Bernie Sanders type, much more populist left-wing candidate get elected to run for the Florida governorship. So I think you're absolutely right that that thesis hasn't really been tested, has it?
No, it hasn't been tested. And I think it would also depend on who that person would be running against. So we have, for example, Manchin is running against someone who is Morrissey, who in his own way is very unpopular in the state because of his ties to the pharmaceutical industry. And so I think Manchin might have had a harder time with Evan Jenkins, who doesn't have that kind of backstory. And so Manchin may very well be able to win the race, and it's looking very good for him. But let's say with Shelley Moore Capito, maybe with Senator Capito, if a progressive were to run against her and there would be a choice between the two, then it's very possible that a progressive could win. Again, that would be tested. That may or may not be tested. It's just going to depend on what the Democratic Party decides to do and what the primaries look like. And I think it's 2 years that her seat is up. But you know, give the people of West Virginia a choice between, say, a very very moderate Democrat that's really more like a Republican, and Shelley Moore Capito. I think Shelley Moore Capito would win, hands down. Including if Manchin were to run against her. So it might be really interesting to see what happens this November and to see whether, for example the mayor from Tallahassee is able to win. And what else? I think there's also the woman from New York, and whose name is escaping me right now, but she also has a very progressive agenda, although New York's not quite the battleground that Florida and West Virginia are.
Well, of course, Manchin, again, there's a big question about whether or not he's going to, starting tomorrow, of course, we have the Kavanaugh hearings, whether or not he's going to vote for Kavanaugh. And the same, of course, is true of Heidi Heitkamp and Claire McCaskill in Missouri. But when you mentioned that Manchin's running against Morrissey, who's tied to Farmer, my God, that should really resonate in West Virginia. West Virginia has the worst incidence of opioid addiction, where in small towns, pharmacies have had hundreds of thousands of prescriptions and hooked hundreds of thousands of people, many of whom died. And of course, the real villains in this case are the big pharma, like Purdue Pharma, who of course now buying full page ads in the New York Times, trying to tell us what great, wonderful people they are.
Yeah, no, I do think it does resonate, actually. I think Morrissey has an uphill battle against Manchin. Manchin is still very popular. Manchin is seen as having done a good job for West Virginians, who tend to be many Democrats tend to be fairly moderate, although there is a very progressive side of West Virginia, as I was stating earlier with the Bernie victory. So I think that people understand that, and they're very angry about that. Morrissey's ads have really tried to tie Manchin to this idea that of clear the swamp, clean the whatever it is that he says, you know, get rid of Manchin because he's just, they're calling him Washington Joe. I'm not sure that really is going to resonate with West Virginians who really haven't seen the swamp drained yet. And that if anything, there's been a lot of swampiness in the current administration. So they may support Trump, but they don't necessarily support all of Trump's people. So no one shed a tear in West Virginia when Scott Pruitt left, for example. So I'm not sure those ads are going to work.
Well, just in closing, on this Labor Day, Anne-Marie LaFazio, we started out talking about how West Virginia's teacher strike is an hopeful example of how collective actions can benefit all, and that's the whole point of unions. Do you think there's a cultural change underway that working Americans are starting to recognize, in spite of the massive propaganda against unions that have been going on for decades? Do you think that people are starting to wake up to the idea that we're better sticking together than, you know, a house divided against itself will not stand? And
right.
we're better sticking together, surely.
I think that you're seeing that with millennials and with my daughter's generation, the Gen Z. I don't know what their name is yet. But I think younger people are starting to understand that. The teacher strike was really amazing because it was women and not necessarily all younger women. Many women who are my age, middle age, were involved in that. But I do think that women are also starting to wake up to that, and people of color are starting to realize that maybe this system isn't really working for all of us and that maybe we really need something a little more egalitarian. And that means banding together to engage in concerted activity. I think when people saw the success of the teacher strike in West Virginia, where West Virginian teachers have almost no rights, the only right public sector employees have in West Virginia is they have a right to join a union. They do not have a right to demand bargaining. And there were many things that the Attorney General went against, the Attorney General, which is, by the way, Morrissey, went against in the teacher strike. And here they won. They won. They were able to get their raise. And now the battle's not over. They still are trying to get better health care benefits. But they're pushing for these things. So, yes, do I think there's hope? I think there's hope that people are starting, that the scales are starting to drop from their eyes and that they're starting to realize that our politicians have not been always working for our interests, that our politicians have been working for big money, pharmaceutical companies, and things like that, and that maybe they do need change. Well, Anne, that's my hope for Labor Day.
Well, thank you, Anne-Marie LaFaza. Thank you for joining us on this Labor Day. And again, I've been speaking with Anne-Marie LaFaza, who's a professor of law at West Virginia University College of Law, where she teaches labor and employment law, jurisprudence, and comparative labor law. She's currently a research scholar for the NYU Center for Labor and Employment and spent 10 years as an attorney with the National Labor Relations Board's appellate and Supreme Court branches. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into how we can beat back the plutocracy.
There's power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past.
I work for the union, 'cause she's so good to me, and I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's the one who hands me down my pay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us on this Labor Day is Sam Pizzagatti, who is a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the editor of the online newsletter Too Much. His books include The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class. And his most recent book is The Case for a Maximum Wage. And he has an article at inequality.org, Would You Recognize a Plutocracy If You Saw One? Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Pizzagatti.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And to answer your question, would you recognize a plutocracy if you saw one, Trump supporters probably don't recognize that we're drifting into both a plutocracy and a kleptocracy. The billionaire class that he has enabled and rewarded, I'm sure they recognize it. The average income for a Trump voter was over $70,000. So the obsession on the part of the Democrats about losing the white working class doesn't sound to really be what the issue is with Trump voters. They tend to be sort of middle class and white, and they think everything's great. They are absolutely thrilled with the economy. And they think all this Robert Mueller stuff and all this stuff in the liberal media is all designed to bring down their hero, that it's all political, and the witch hunt is political, and he's doing a great job. So how do you burst that bubble?
Well, I think the best way to burst that bubble is to point people towards reality. And that reality shows that we have become an incredibly top-heavy society. And there's all sorts of indications of that. To me, one of the most vivid is that if you look back at 1980, which was in the lifetime of many of us, back in 1980, the bottom 50% of Americans, that is the poorest half of Americans, had twice as much wealth as the top 1% of our society. Bottom 50% now, back in 1980, twice as much wealth as the top 1%. That situation has been essentially stood on its head. Now the top 1% has nearly twice as much as the bottom 50%. That's an incredible switch in our society. You know, we've gone from a society in the middle of 20th century that was moving towards greater equality to a society that has become staggeringly more unequal. And that reality is in our face each and every day.
But not necessarily in the face of people with 401ks. The stock market has reached an historical milestone of 3,453 days of a bull market, the longest bull market in American financial history. So again, you don't have to convince me, Sam, that we're a plutocracy run by a kleptocrat who's probably owned and manipulated by a foreign Russian hostile power who's also a kleptocrat. So that's the reality. But the reality is not getting through. And you know, the Democrats are talking about a blue wave in November. Last week in the primaries in Florida and in Arizona, more Republicans voted than Democrats. There's more enthusiasm on the Republican side than on the Democratic side. So I think we need a reality check here, and I just wonder how you win over the moderates or the independents in the middle, and also how do you motivate people to get out and vote who are being screwed by this president and by the plutocracy?
Well, I think the key way to do that is to advance proposals that speak to issues, that speak to concerns that people already have. So let's look at one particular example. Let's look at on this Labor Day. Let's look at CEO compensation. Last year, CEOs at our biggest 350 companies averaged more than 312 times what their most typical workers make. 312 times. Now, it's interesting. Stanford University did a study 2 years ago, and they asked people, what do you think should be the margin between top CEOs and their average workers? And the average response that Americans gave was six times. So we have a situation where CEOs are making 312 times what their average workers are making, their median workers are making. And people, average Americans, believe that gap should be six times. I was just involved, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Last week, we put out a study that looked at how our tax dollars are subsidizing this incredible, excessive CEO compensation. More than two-thirds of the top 50 contractors and the top 50 corporate subsidy recipients paid their CEOs last year more than 100 times their median worker pay. So what if we advance proposals? What if our candidates advanced proposals that said no government contracts, no government corporate welfare subsidies to corporations that pay their typical workers, their CEOs, more than 10 or 25 or 50 times their workers? If we advance proposals like that, we'd be speaking to ideas that average Americans support. And I think that's the way we need to speak to the general American public, by advancing proposals that speak to issues they care about.
And again, I'm speaking with Sam Pizzagatti, who is a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and an editor of the online newsletter Too Much. His books include The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class, and his most recent book is The Case for a Maximum Wage. And he has an article at inequality.org, Would You Recognize a Plutocracy If You Saw One? Let's talk about then in terms, because I'm asking you about leadership and a narrative to reverse this giveaway to the rich at the expense of working Americans in the middle class. And that's a trend we've been on. American workers haven't had a real raise since the 1970s, and wages are flat, whereas in the executive suite, they're just rolling in dough, buying back stock. That in itself is detrimental to American capitalism, because if you're CEOs are only interested in stock prices and buying back stock and taking care of themselves. They're not investing in R&D and in new equipment, and they probably don't even visit the factory floor. It's so bifurcated now between the worker and the CEO. They're different worlds, really. So what do you make of Elizabeth Warren's new plan to reshape American capitalism?
Well, I think her program. She's talking about some different ideas that that have real promise, and she's also talking about some anti-corruption initiatives that have real promise. And I think that's what we need to be doing. We need to be advancing real nitty-gritty proposals, and getting down to specifics on how we can build a better society in this country. And I think if we do that, on this Labor Day and on every day, that we will reverse the trends that Donald Trump is pushing our nation towards.
Well, it's particularly galling that Donald Trump ran as a populist and is taking care of plutocrats. And again, you just scratch your head and cannot figure out why people don't see it. Now, one of the reasons people don't see it is that people inside the Trump Fox News bubble are told totally different narrative. I mean, they're in a fact-free world, and they have their own facts, and all of them support Donald Trump and the plutocracy. So it's a very strange phenomenon that we have here in post-truth America. I'm not sure how that gap is bridged. But what about basic activism? I mean, last week Donald Trump told a bunch of evangelicals that the liberal left is going to get violent in this election.
Yes.
So that's about the last furthest thing from the truth. I'm not suggesting the liberals and the progressives should get violent, but they certainly should get active.
Yes, and again, I mean, it sounds like a broken record here, but if we advance proposals that excite people, bold proposals that speak to real problems that we have, bold proposals that reduce the power of the wealthy in our society, I think we can make a real difference. So, so in Elizabeth Warren's plan, for instance, she's saying that 40% of every corporate board should be elected by workers. And that's a very simple proposal, but it's fundamentally important to take a step like that. Corporate board members see the corporate books, see the games that corporations are playing with their income, revenues, and outlays. Workers should see those games, and if workers saw those games, maybe we could begin to stop them.
Well, nobody could suggest that the Germans don't have a successful economy and a particularly successful export economy. In fact, Trump rails against Mercedes-Benz and BMW until I think he was told that they have huge factories here in South Carolina in the United States. But one of the reasons why I think the German economy is so successful is that by law, a certain percentage of seats on the boards of the major corporations have got to be for union representatives.
And so it's 50% in Germany.
It's 50%. So there you have an example that it works. But I guess, you know, I never understood this kind of, I know they teach it at Wharton and Harvard Business School, all this sort of militaristic, jingoistic stuff about CEOs taking no prisoners, slash and burn, and all these macho images that they have. But mostly it seems like a complete fiction and a fraud. I mean, how could you have skills that translate? You run a company that builds nuclear submarines, and then you get hired by a company that cans pineapples and manufactures bicycles. And somehow that expertise translates, and you're worth hundreds of millions a year, no matter what the product is?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring there up. There actually is a legitimate academic discipline called management science that's devoted to how do you run enterprises so that they operate in an effective and efficient way, and that's a legitimate a piece of business for academic study, because for as long as humanity exists, we're going to depend on enterprises of one sort or another, and those enterprises should function, should operate efficiently and effectively. So what do the researchers in this area tell us? Well, they tell us that the wider the gap between top executives and their workers in compensation, the less effective and less efficient the enterprises are. If you have CEOs that grab a disproportionate share of the wealth an enterprise creates, that's not going to be an effective, efficient organization. Average workers are not going to give their best if they feel ripped off by the executives who run a corporation. So if we followed management science, if we followed people like Peter Drucker, the late Peter Drucker, who's the founder of modern management science, we would be paying no top executive more than 20 or 25 times what workers in that company are making. Instead, the gap is over 10 times that wide.
But I think this system has led to a kind of social apartheid in this country, where CEOs and corporate executives live in gated communities, very rarely even see average people, working people, middle class people, you know, the Betsy DeVos's of this world with all of their yachts registered in the Cayman Islands. They're completely insulated against reality. And some of the wealthiest people now are migrating down to Florida, where, of course, they have pretty lax income tax and you can't lose your property in bankruptcy. Like Ocala, Florida, they built this whole wealthy enclave around airstrips for private jets, where you just literally land the private jet and just taxi up to your house or mansion, I guess.
Yeah.
And then on the other side of your mansion, you have a golf course. So, and you have your own little stores and restaurants and stuff. So you just literally live in a cocoon. So what is it about the gap or the reality gap between our sort of historical notion of being an egalitarian society to this incredibly class-structured plutocratic society? Is there any way to sort of shame the rich and wake up the poor to the big lie that we aren't an egalitarian society and we're not a meritocracy?
Well, I think that there is fairly wide understanding now that we don't live in an egalitarian society, that we do live in a deeply unequal society. Gallup did some polling this past spring, repeating polling that it did 6 years ago. And the key question to me in this poll was, does the United States benefit from having a class of rich people? And they divided the answers by party, Republican, Independent, and Democrat. If you look at the Republican answers back 6 years ago, 79% of people said the United States benefits from having a class of rich people. And today it's 80%. So essentially there's been no change. If you look on Democrats, on the other hand, back in 2012, a majority of Democrats, 52%, said we do benefit from having a class of rich people. Today, in 2018, only 43% of Democrats say we benefit from having a class of rich people. So I think that's a sign of things to come, that more and more Americans are understanding, majority of Democrats now, self-identified Democrats, are understanding that we don't benefit from living in an unequal society. We don't benefit from living with a spectacularly rich. We don't benefit that there is no trickle down. So I'm encouraged by that finding. I think American public opinion is very much moving in the right direction.
Well, Sam Pizzicati, I thank you very much for joining us on this Labor Day.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sam Pizzicati, who's a veteran labor journalist, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and an editor at the online newsletter Too Much. His books include The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class, and his most recent book is The Case for a Maximum Wage. And he has an article at inequality.org, Would You Recognize a Plutocracy If You Saw One? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.